Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 4 minutes after 9 a.m., January 27th, 2012. With me today at the committee is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, and South Senator Stebbins. We've got several visiting senators in the room here. We have Senator Pascavan, Senator French, Senator Dyson, Senator Diesel. Today we're going to have four bills on the agenda. We're going to start in first reading with Senate Bill 167, the Separate Oil and Gas Production Tax. And we're going to follow it with Senate Bill 103, Workers' Compensation for Firefighters, Senate Bill 51, State Vending Licenses, Senate Bill 30, Return of Seized Property. We're going to start with Senate Bill 167 by the Senate Finance Committee to separate oil and gas production. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the committee staff introduce the bill, take invited testimony by the Department of Revenue, and then set the bill aside for further review. We will not be taking public testimony today on this piece of legislation. And with that, I'd like to ask Darwin Peterson for my staff to come forward, please. Introduce himself for the record and who he represents. And take us through this bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, good morning. My name is Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman. Senate Bill 167 separates some oil and natural gas for purposes of calculating the progressivity portion of the production tax under AS 4355. This effort has become commonly known as decoupling. Under the current ACES tax system, oil and gas are taxed at one rate based on the combined BTU equivalent of value of both commodities. However, oil and gas are two distinct hydrocarbon commodities with vastly different economic value. Recently, North Slope crude has been trading at around $110 per barrel, while the price for natural gas has been hovering around $3 per million BTUs. That means right now oil is over 40 times the value of natural gas on a BTU equivalency. When oil is priced significantly higher than gas, Alaska's coupled tax structure allows lower value gas to dilute the revenues generated by higher value oil. The net effect is lower tax liabilities for producers and reduced revenue for Alaska. Under forecasted production and pricing scenarios, the state could potentially see upwards of a $2 billion per year loss in revenue in the event of a major gas sale. In other words, Alaska will be getting no money for its gas and even less money for its oil. The current tax structure not only exposes the state to unnecessary financial risk, but it also creates economic instability and financial uncertainty for partners looking to invest in a natural gas pipeline. Under this bill, there would be two distinct progressivity calculations, which would produce two different tax rates to be applied separately. First, progressivity will be calculated on all combined current activity, oil, Cook Inlet gas, and other in-state gas. Second, progressivity would be calculated separately on North Slope gas that is exported out of state. Exclusion of North Slope export gas from the progressivity calculation for oil means the gas will not dilute the value of the oil, and oil taxes will not be reduced as a result of a major gas sale. The progressivity calculation itself will be unchanged based on 0.4% of the production tax value that exceeds $30 per barrel for oil and $30 per BTU barrel of oil equivalent for gas. The base tax rate is also unchanged at 25% of production value. As in current law, this bill gives the Department of Revenue the authority to adopt regulations to allocate costs between oil and gas. As recipients of confidential cost data, the department is in the best position to evaluate costs. That concludes my overview, Mr. Chairman. Just like to point out to the committee, there are some documents in your packet. One is a letter from David Wood to Senator Stedman from March 2010, when we were working on a same piece of legislation, different legislature. That was Senate Bill 305.
If we could just stop there for a minute, just for the folks watching at home, Dr. David Wood is a consultant working with legislative budget and audit that helped us with our gas physical structure and other questions that may come up dealing with our gas drain. Go ahead and continue.
The letter from Dr. Wood to Senator Stedman provides scenarios showing the production tax calculations for FY 08 and 09 for standalone oil, standalone gas, and then oil and gas combined. It's still obviously very relevant to the debate today. And the other document is a PowerPoint presentation provided by Logston and Associates, also back in March 2010. We received permission from Chuck Logston to reprint this. All we've done is changed the cover page from Senate Bill 305 to Senate Bill 167. The information in that PowerPoint is still relevant to the debate on Senate Bill 167. With that, Mr. Chairman, be happy to turn it back over to the committee, and I believe the Department of Revenue is here to provide a presentation.
Okay. Thank you. That I'd like to go ahead and invite the Commissioner of Revenue to come forward, please. The commissioner could introduce himself, and I've asked him to bring forward his trusty aides, and I'll let you guys go ahead and move back and forth amongst yourselves how you want to do the presentation. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. With me is the Deputy Commissioner for the Tax Division, Bruce Tangeman, as well as our Assistant Chief Economist, Dan Stickle. We're aiming here to give you a pretty high-level view of decoupling. I know most of you are aware of the issue. A considerable amount of time two sessions ago was spent on it, so we're just going to kind of lay out some of the basics, and in fact, much of what we're going to talk about are also very similar to the slides that you see in the Logston presentation. So I will turn to Mr. Tangeman and Mr. Stickle to give most of the presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner. For the record, Bruce Tangeman, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue. The overview of the presentation we will be presenting this morning is we're going to start with some very high-level sort of catch-up overviews of how the production tax works in the state of Alaska. We'll touch on what is decoupling, why decouple, some decoupling issues that we see, and we'll close with a brief history of SB 305, which was passed in 2010. Brief overview of the production tax as it currently works. It's a company-specific tax. The progressivity is affects each taxpayer slightly differently, depending on their production volumes. It's based on the production tax value. This is basically the net tax, as opposed to a gross tax, which the state used to operate under. The PTV is affected by the market price. Less transportation costs gets you to the gross value at the point of production. The gross value at the point of production minus lease expenditures then gets you to the production tax value. The tax rate there's four bullets that basically explain how it's technically calculated. I don't think we need to get into too much.
Mr. Tangeman, you know, this is our first hearing of many hearings as we go down the road over the next 70 days or 60 days or however long we're going to be working on this issue here at the committee. So it would be nice to just go ahead and walk through and explain even some of the more basic stuff in your slides for the people at home that aren't working with this every day like we are, and especially the acronyms. We want to be careful with acronyms, and it'll get very complicated as we go forward, put it that way.
Absolutely, Senator, no problem. So the tax rate, how the tax rate's calculated. The base tax rate is 25% of the production tax value. So that would be the net amount after you back out the transportation costs, lease expenditures, et cetera. The progressivity applies when the production tax value is over $30 BOE, which is barrel of oil equivalent, and increases at a rate of 0.4% for each dollar of production tax value over $30. An example, at $50 barrel of oil equivalent production tax value, the tax rate is 33%. So it would be 25% plus 0.4 times that additional $20 with above 30. At $92.50, the barrel of oil equivalent progressivity changes to 0.1% per dollar above $92.50. This is what is commonly referred to as the income statement. We include these at the back of the revenue sources book each year. I believe these were put together at the request of this committee and Chairman Stedman. It's meant to be a high-level snapshot view of the state and how the price and the deductions get you to the production tax value. It's mainly used to walk you down through the steps and how do you get to the bottom line revenue. Again, this is a high-level view. As we mentioned before, the tax is very company specific, so it's hard to get a solid detail on something this complex for this many taxpayers. So this is meant to be a higher level view. The tax is calculated on a monthly basis, which also makes it a little more complicated. So this is an annual roll-up view, basically. So for FY 2011, which just ended in June 30 of this 2011, the average annual oil price was $94.49. Average production was 602,723 barrels for a value of $56.9 million a day. The next lines down are the total annual production of 219 million, almost 220 million barrels of oil. The royalty and federal barrels are backed out. Those aren't taxed for a taxable barrels of 190.5 million barrels. The downstream transportation costs are backed out. The ANS marine transportation, the TAPS tariff of $4.02, other transportation costs for the total transportation cost of $7.17 per barrel. The lease expenditures, these are your operating expenditures and capital expenditures. Again, this is an average for $21.74. These will vary between companies. That takes us to the total production tax value of $12,492,600. This is what the tax is then calculated on. So, using the $94.49, the base rate of 25% is calculated on the first $30, and that would equal $3.1 billion. The remainder is calculated with the 0.4 incremental going up. That 0.4 is then applied to the entire tax base for an additional $1.8 billion, so total tax due before credits of $4.9 billion. Credits applied of $400 million takes us to a total tax after credit of $4.5 billion.
And just as a reminder, the $400 in credits, there's another $400 buried in the system for a total of roughly $800.
Correct. This is the $400 that's applied against the tax liability. The tax credits that are taken by explorers who do not have a tax liability is a separate category. So what is decoupling? Under current law, gas production from major gas sales will be converted to barrel of oil equivalent, BOE, and taxed in the same calculation as oil. Decoupling would calculate oil and gas tax for major gas sales separately. And Mr. Peterson touched on that briefly in his opening remarks also. So conceptually, this is a pretty nice way to look at it. The way it's currently set up on the left is coupled, so you have the oil and gas combined all the way down through the varying calculations. On the right-hand side, you would split them into oil calculated straight down and then the gas calculated straight down. So conceptually, it's when you look at it this way, it's a little easier to understand, I think. Why decouple? Oil is different than gas, different uses, different resource endowments, different substitutes. Decoupling allows tax policy to be crafted specific to oil or gas production. Oil is currently worth more than gas per unit of energy. Mr. Peterson also addressed that. And the gas value relative to oil varies greatly over time, as we're currently seeing right now. So right now, the parity is the big issue. The thermal parity, B2 equivalent, is approximately 6 to 1. But the gas price and the oil price clearly aren't in a 6 to 1 parity at this point. And this is the dotted line, the red dotted line, shows the 6 to 1 parity. And the blue line is the actual oil price.
And Mr. Tangeman, I think if we were to use current oil prices at $112 and current gas at about $2.70, we're looking at about 40 to 1. So depending on here in the chart, you're using West Texas versus ANS, you know, versus Brent C or whatever you want to measure. So we'll work on that as we go forward. We'll be selecting one as a standard base so it doesn't move around. And the last time we worked on the bill, depending on the presentation, sometimes there were different oil prices. So we'll work on some of the refinements of that with your department. So where everybody's talking the same issue, but clearly the multiplier there or the equivalency is roughly 22-23 here on your chart, and on our current oil and current gas in the market, it's 40 to 1.
Why decouple? Including lower value gas in the same tax calculation as higher value oil reduces the average value per BOE and therefore reduces the progressive tax rate on oil. By taxing oil and gas together, gas production reduces oil taxes even though oil operations are unaffected. Of course, we aren't realizing this at this moment because we are not realizing gas production on a commercial level. So this has been called the flip the switch problem. As soon as we do realize a major gas sale, the state revenue could drop significantly under certain price scenarios.
And as I recall, when we had previous discussions on this, we had the Nikiski gas plant running, and we're looking well north of $100 million current impact on the Treasury, as I recall. And now that plant's been shut down, so I'd expect the current gas dilution effect that we're seeing today is well under $100 million, and we'll work on those calculations sometime. But it's not in the billions as the flip-to-switch issue is addressing. This is a hypothetical if we had the 4.5 BCF gas line running.
Yes, sir.
Correct. Thank you.
So some numerical examples. These are the next few slides will be fairly recognizable to the folks that went through this discussion in the presentations a couple years ago. We were asked to update some of those slides with using prices. So over the next several slides, we show some scenarios. So it's a one-year income statement model. The DOR 2012 profiles of 450 barrels per day and 4.5 billion cubic feet per day of gas. The conversion of 6 to 1 parity. And the cost allocations, 2.5 billion in OPEX, $2.5 billion in CAPEX. Cost split on the basis of gross value at the point of production. Transportation costs of $11 per barrel for oil and $4.50 per million BTU of gas. So those are the assumptions that we're using for the next several slides.
Okay, just a second on the, if we can back up, and it's, as we're working on here on the conceptual issue we're going to have on the table here, but the 450,000 barrels a day, I think in the 13 forecast we're using 575, roughly rounded off.
Senator Stedman, correct.
Okay.
So this slide at high parity, 15-to-1 parity, of oil price of $120 a barrel, gas price at $8 per MMBTU. The left-hand column is oil standalone and gas standalone, so that would be decoupled for a total of $5.9 billion. The blue bar is the status quo as currently calculated. SB 167 would equal the that's the whole point, is to mimic the first column with the oil calculated separately and the gas calculated separately. So the right column would be the delta between decoupling and coupling. So slide 12 is a slightly different scenario. We use the same oil price of $120 a barrel, a $15 per MMBTU of gas, same oil production, same gas production. The status quo, the blue column, would be $9.8 billion. The split, the decoupled, would be $10.3 billion for a delta of $500 million. So this slide gets us close to the 6-to-1 parity. So in order to do that, we're showing a $90 barrel of oil, $15 per MMBTU of gas, same production for both. The status quo as currently calculated would be $7.1 billion. And as you can see, the decoupled columns are both 7.1. On the right, they're not quite 7-1, so there is a slight delta, but this is to show at the 6-to-1 parity, it's fairly equal, the calculation between the two. So obviously the way the oil price has risen and the gas price has dropped, that's where you would see the difference in these calculations. We included this slide just to put it into context of what we're seeing today. Obviously, if any gas, or when gas commercialization comes on, it will be a few years down the road. But today, with gas price at $3, gas price is less than the transportation costs. I believe we showed $4.50 as the transportation cost for gas. So the gas tax would result in a net operating loss and generate an NOL credit of $600 million, which could be applied in the following year. So the NOL is a carry forward loss.
So this, we're back up to $2 billion in the marginal spread here, 1.9 minus status quo.
Excuse me, sir?
We're up to basically $2 billion, $1.9 billion.
Yes, sir.
For the record, my name is Dan Stickle, Assistant Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. The $1.9 billion showed there does not include the $600 million credit for the gas net operating loss that could be taken in the following year.
Could you repeat that? I got to speak up a little bit too up here.
Right. The $1.9 billion delta here between SB 167 and status quo does not take into account the $600 million credit. This looks at what would the revenue be in the particular year, but you would have the $600 million that you could take in the following year. So netting them out,
million.
You're looking at 1.3.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
So some observations. SB 167 provides for a state share similar to the status quo when gas prices are relatively high. That would be that 6-to-1 parity slide that we showed a couple slides back. SB 167 imposes a higher state share compared to the status quo when gas prices are relatively low. SB 167 generates revenue equal to or greater than oil standalone revenue in all cases. But at very low gas prices, the net operating loss credits are generated, which can be applied against the oil tax liability in the following year. Some decoupling issues that we see. Cost allocation is obviously one of the biggest issues. How costs are allocated between oil and gas has a significant impact on the overall taxes allowed. Because oil and gas are generally produced together, it's not easy or straightforward to determine the costs applicable to gas or oil. The cost allocation method could result in uncertainty, disputes, and delays. So I think that'll be one of the critical discussion points going forward is that we address cost allocation. Cost allocation should be specified in the statute and is a very important policy decision. Here's an example of cost allocations. Again, we're assuming $120 barrel of oil, $8 MMBTU for gas. The production,
this is million barrels per year.
Okay. So the oil production of 164 million barrels a year, gas 274 MMBTU for a total of 438. The gross value at the point of production is a calculation. So the split would be based on the 15-to-1. And
you want me to jump in?
Yeah, you want.
So what this slide is showing is three potential methods for allocating costs between oil and gas under a decoupled tax. There's pretty much any number of allocation methods that you could think up that you could use, but these are three of the most common ones that have been cited. So on the top column, what we're doing is saying, what is the barrels of oil equivalent produced in the year? Under our scenario, it's 164 million barrels of oil and 274 million barrels of oil equivalent of gas. At this point, on an energy basis, with a 450,000 barrels of production and 4.5 BCF of gas, there's actually more gas than oil being produced. When you look at the gross value, the gross value of the oil is $17.9 billion versus $5.7 billion for gas. So if you go down to the second set of numbers, what does the cost allocation look like if you split costs based on the barrels of oil equivalent? Well, 63% of the costs get assigned to gas, and only 38% of the total costs of $5 billion get assigned to oil. So your deduction of costs for your oil tax is going to be about $1.9 billion. Now, if you go down and split the costs between oil and gas based on the value at point of production, since your oil tax has a much higher share of the total value, you assign 76% of the costs to oil for a deduction of about $3.8 billion. And if you ask the companies to assign the costs to either oil or gas, I know there's a lot of issues that would go into defining how those costs would be assigned. But if you assume that about 90% of the costs went to oil, then you'd have $4.5 billion deducted against your oil tax. So as you can see here, which cost allocation method is specified ends up being a multi-billion dollar decision for deductions. And if we go to the next slide, you can see what that means in terms of revenue. The column on the left, using the same $120 per barrel oil price and $8 per MMBTU gas price that we've been using in our other slides, if you allocate based on barrel of oil equivalency, which is where you had the lowest amount of costs assigned to oil, you end up getting a total of $7 billion in state revenue. If you allocate based on value at point of production, we receive $5.9 billion in state revenue. And if you allocate based on a 90-10 cost split, which is where we had the most costs assigned to oil, you have a $5.5 billion in total revenue. So just between these three potential cost allocation methods in this one scenario, which cost allocation method you choose is a $1.5 billion per year decision. And so the next slide looks at some of the other issues that will need to be addressed as we go down the decoupling road. We're not going to get into an extreme level of detail on any of these. One issue is how this affects the lock-in for gas that may have been committed at the first AGIA open season. That gas tax is locked in for a period of time after the start of production from the project. What is the potential impact of the decoupling statute on current gas production? How are we going to treat the Cook Inlet gas used in state? And there is small quantities of current gas production that does not qualify for the Cook Inlet or gas used in state. How complex is this going to be from an administration standpoint for the state and for the taxpayers? Do we want to specify and take care of the gas tax now, or do we save that for deliberations in another session at another time? What is the balance between the desire for state revenue and the desire to make the gas a major gas project attractive to the producers? And finally, and we touched on this one earlier, if you do have a situation where you have gas prices and oil prices similar to where they are now, how are we going to treat that net operating loss for gas? Are we going to allow them, the producers, to deduct those expenses in the year occurred against an oil tax? Are we going to give them, as statute would have it now, where you get a credit that you can apply in a future year?
If we could just, we've got two more slides, so if we could just jump back to 14, and I just want to clarify, issue so I'm understanding clearly what's on the table. On the left-hand side, there's $1.9 billion, which would be the net difference between our current standalone, our current system and then the bill in front of us. But then you said there was a $600,000 credit? Yes. $600 million credit. So when you take the $600 million credit, that would reduce the future tax. And which way does it push that 1.9 number?
It would go down to 1.3.
Okay.
Right. So the intent of this slide was to look at what is the revenue generated in the snapshot year that we're looking at. And as it stands now, in the snapshot year, you would receive the $3.1 billion under the decoupled tax. However, you'd have that additional $600 million in credits outstanding.
To move against it?
Future tax
in a future tax liability.
Okay, thank you. Jump back to your two-page conclusion.
So 2 years ago, for those of us that were so fortunate, we went down this road with Senate Bill 305 in 2010. And what does Senate Bill 305 do? Well, it decoupled oil and major gas sales and solved this flip-the-switch problem of having a significant drop in state revenue once major gas sales began. And also in Senate Bill 305, it was set up in a way that held harmless most current gas production. And the way it did that is by setting one tax calculation for oil, but also including the Cook Inlet gas and the gas used in state in that tax and progressivity calculation. And it established a separate tax and progressivity calculation that applied to the non-Cook Inlet gas that is not used in state. And in SB 305, statute would have specified that gross value at point of production was the cost allocation method, and the Department of Revenue would use gross value at point of production to the extent possible to allocate costs between oil and gas. So we spent a lot of time on this. There was an extensive analysis done by the legislature, consultants, the administration. We raised a lot of technical issues and addressed most of those. And that final bill from 2 years ago is the basis for 167, which is before us this year.
And as you know, of course, Mr. Chairman, SB 305 in 2010 passed the Senate and the House and was vetoed by the governor. In his veto message, three of the reasons cited were that his belief that decoupling on its own represents an overall tax increase, that changing the tax during the pipeline open season, which was occurring with the GN Denali, created uncertainty, and that a change was not needed at this time because the legislature retains the ability to make changes to tax laws. Any tax locked in for firm commitments at the first open season would only apply to gas, not oil. It's 2 years later. The AGEA open season's complete. The Denali project has been suspended. Decoupling's now been on the table and thought of and considered for the last 2 years. And there's an opportunity to reconsider decoupling in context of the broader discussion of increasing oil and gas production. The governor has the concerns in number one. It is still a concern for the governor. But it's the Department of Revenue's feeling that we can work with the committee and come up with something that can be agreeable to both parties. I'd also like to mention, just kind of on a higher level, most of you are aware the governor has set out a pretty aggressive timeline for the three producers on taking a look at moving forward a gas line. And if those timelines are held to some degree, to a great degree, we may be looking at working on the gas tax issue in the 2013 session.
We have any initial questions for the department? Then we'll start with the co-chair Hoffman, then we'll go down to Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the schedules 10 through 14, and you have assumptions for 12. I wonder if you could prepare those same schedules on actuals for FY11 and in those give us the differences so we can give a comparative analysis of what your assumptions were in 12 as compared to how they would be impacted by actual numbers in 11. And if you could prepare those for the committee.
We will do that, Senator Hoffman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, as we look at what's going on here, I'm assuming what you're saying is that if you get this bill through, the governor won't be likely to go ahead and veto it like he did the last time. Is that?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, what I'm saying is that the bill as it sits introduced, which is exactly the same as SB 305, the governor has concerns with, but we feel comfortable that we can work with the committee and to a degree that both of us will be comfortable moving forward, that wouldn't be the same result, hopefully.
And as you look at this decoupling bill, what do other oil-producing and gas-producing states do, and nations for that matter, because we were over to Norway this last fall, and they were somewhat set back because of they were decoupled. What do other states do in light of the situation like this?
Yeah, Senator Olson through the chair, there's states and countries that do it both ways, and we'd be happy to provide some information on different jurisdictions.
Seeing no other initial questions, we have one fiscal note from the Department of Revenue for $330,000 in general funds to cover the cost of public workshops and contractual assistance and draft regulations. Again, we are not going to have a public testimony on this bill today. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for further review and analysis. And with that, I'd like to thank the commissioner for coming forward and his trustee aides. And committee's looking forward to working with the department and working through these issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, Senate Bill 103 by the Judiciary Committee regarding workers' compensation for firefighters, and we're going to have a brief at ease. Please. We're going to start now with Senate Bill 103 by the Judiciary Committee regarding workers' compensation for firefighters. This is the second hearing on this bill. We heard it for the first time the 20th of January. The intent today is to bring the bill back up for further consideration and look to the will of the committee. Does committee members have any questions, concerns, or amendments? Seeing none, we have a motion, Senator Ellis. Because your trustee co-chair is gone to move the bill?
He's coming back.
Okay. Senator Ellis has been bailed out by Senator Hoffman. We have a motion to move the bill, please.
Never want to steal the co-chair's thunder.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Finance Committee move out Senate Bill 103, Workman's Comp for Firefighters, and accompanying fiscal notes with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral. But let me just back up just for a second, if I could, just to read in the record that we've got a zero fiscal note from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, one fiscal note from the Department of Admin for $69,700 in interagency receipts reflecting potential impact of risk management, one fiscal note from the University of Alaska for $77,400 in general funds reflecting the potential impact of risk services, and we'll attach those as it moves on to the next committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, Senate Bill number 51 by Senator Davis regarding state vending licenses. This is the second hearing on this bill. We heard it on the 20th of January. The intent today is to bring the bill back up for further considerations and look to the will of the committee. Do we have any questions? Amendments? Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee move Senate Bill 51, State Vending License, with accompanying fiscal notes from the committee with individual recommendations.
Okay, we have 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and we have a motion to move the bill from committee to the next committee or referral with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill to the next committee referral. Next up, Senate Bill 30 by Senator Dyson regarding the return of seized property. This is the second hearing on this bill. We heard it for the first time the 20th of January. The intent today is to bring the bill back for further consideration. Look to the will of the committee. We have 2 fiscal notes in your packet, 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Public Safety, 1 indeterminate fiscal note from the Department of Law. Do we have any questions, concerns, or amendments? Seeing none, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee move out Senate Bill 36, return of seized property, Senate Bill 30, return of seized property with accompanying fiscal notes and individual recommendations from the committee.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with the individual recommendations and attached 2 fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee to the next committee referral. Next meeting, that concludes today.
Thank you.
Next meeting is Monday, January 30th. We have three bills on the agenda. Senate Bill 9, raise compulsory school attendance age. Senate Bill 137, suicide awareness, prevention, and training. Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 2, uniform rules, presiding officer pro tem. We are adjourned.